Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Jim Kuzman is here. He literally wrote the book on the Omnia 9 audio processor. He knows all about what's going on inside. He's going to teach us a lot of the theory behind undo, declipping, and multiband audio processing. It's all coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, our 532nd episode, 532, doing this for over 11 years now. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. And I am snowed in, iced in. I ain't going anywhere. It is awful out there. We had round one this past weekend, and round two coming through right now. It is nasty. Let's hope the lights stay on. That'd be terrific. Welcome to the show, This Week in Radio Tech, where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower, like that one. And this week, we're going to talk about something really important that everybody has an opinion on, everybody has an idea about. Most everybody considers themselves at least a little bit of an expert in this field. We're talking about audio processing. Audio processing. Unless you're from Canada, then it's definitely audio processing. And I hear a little giggle in the background. And look, it's my friend, my colleague, my confidant in audio processing secrets. It's Jim Kuzman. Hey, Jim, welcome in.
Hey, Kirk. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. It's so good to see you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Oh, man. We hardly ever get to talk. And wait, I bet you've got snow at your place, too, up there. And where do you live? Pennsylvania, Ohio?
Ohio. So I'm in the Youngstown, Ohio area. And okay. Yeah, we've got some snow and ice, and it's going to go down to single digits tonight, which I think we're still warmer than Texas. So it's okay.
Now, Jim, you're my colleague at Telos, but I never get to deal with you. You're kind of what do you do at Telos anyway?
Boy, a lot of people ask that question. What they like to know.
Just be scared when HR asks. Okay?
Exactly. What is it that you do? Yes. My current position is technical writer, which is ironically the position I was hired for in 2011. I came into the company through the Linear Acoustic brand at the time and did technical writing. And I've done a whole bunch of things in between. I've done some marketing stuff. I did field support for Linear Acoustic for television for a while. Did strategic marketing for a while. And so I've just kind of gone where they need me to go, and they needed a technical writer again, and so I'm kind of right back where I started.
How did you get to be a pretty good expert, well known for audio processing? How'd that happen?
That started out, I'm a musician, and I've always had, kind of an ear for things. I've always been able to sort of hear things that other people didn't hear, sort of the subtleties and nuances. And when I got my start in radio, I was hired at a station here in Youngstown right out of college, and I did a whole bunch of stuff there too. You know, as you do, you clean the bathrooms, change the oil in the news cars, whatever, empty the waste baskets, whatever, to get into the business. And so, but I always had my eye on engineering, and specifically in audio. And it's just something that always fascinated me. I would dial around, and you could hear the differences in the different stations, and that always kind of piqued my interest. So that started pretty early on.
We're going to talk about a couple of things that Jim has done, including a little bit of his work at Disney and some other places. I want to tell you that I'm so proud that this week in Radio Tech, we have a relationship with Radio Guide. And I thought this is a framed Radio Guide. It's framed. And why did I frame it? Well, because I'm kind of proud. I'm lucky and proud. This picture, I took this picture over 16 years ago, the very first Axia audio console. In fact, it's branded Telos. It was before they decided on the Axia name.
Wow.
Was going to be on everything. It actually says Telos on the console. It's a Telos smart surface, and it's at Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama. I snapped this picture as well as a few others, and Ray Top, 16 years ago, January 2005, put this on the cover. And I just mentioned that because Radio Guide is a great place to go. You can go to radio-guide.com online, or you can ask for your paper copy of Radio Guide. It comes out every other month. It's full of articles that are in depth. They have room in this magazine to go a little bit in depth, like your IT guide, the Linux connection, etc., from Tommy Gray. And here's All Digital AM, The Time Has Come, from Greg Skull. Just lots of good stuff in here. I look forward to this every month. And let's see if I can find, where did it go? Somewhere in here. Oh, well, now I can't find it. It had a really good picture that has to do with this show, but I'll have to find it later. That's the problem with paper. You got to page through it. Anyway, pick up your Radio Guide. Great, great magazine. Appreciate it. All right. We're going to talk about audio processing in some real depth. And Jim, you're going to give a tutorial on audio processing.
I am.
But I want to point out that you're going to, as best you can, talk about general principles, but we've got to use something as an example. Mm-hmm. And tell us about the example piece of equipment that we're going to use to teach audio processing.
So what we're going to use is the Omnia 9, which has been with us. Oh my goodness. When did about 8 years ago now, 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. I got familiar with the Omnia 9 early on. I was still working for Radio Disney at the time. And there's a story there too, as to, you know, how I sort of, muscled my way or into the Omnia fold, through the 9 and, mm-hmm. and actually before I was actually working for the company, I was hired as a freelance writer, to write the documentation and the user manual, the War and Peace, of manuals. So I got familiar with the 9 really early on. So that's what we're going to use today.
Now, one of the things about the Omnia 9, and we're going to give a little preview here. We're going to be spending a lot of time on this screen and screens that look like it. Mm-hmm. And one reason, a couple things, you know, people ask, and we've done webinars on, hey, which Omnia processor should I get? There's mm-hmm. so many of them. Mm-hmm. They have different feature sets. They're really even not even designed quite the same way. They're designed by different designers.
Yep.
And we chose the Omnia 9 for this show for a couple of reasons. One, you have that right there. You're an expert on it. You wrote the manual. But number two, it's good for showing off a lot of principles.
Absolutely.
But it also has some features that are interesting that other processors may not have. In fact, there are even some, you know, other Omnia processors may not have. Mm-hmm. But the Omnia 9, some people consider it really complicated. Now, you've been able to simplify a lot of its operation, and you explain how to use the basic mode for it. But in this hour, you're going to be able to mm-hmm. take your time and explain to your heart's desire different features and functions and different ways to treat audio to make it better and better, right?
That is the plan. Yes, sir.
We ought to start with the Omnia 9 is designed to be an FM audio processor, and it can also do HD at the same time, and mm-hmm. it can be outfitted to simultaneously with separate paths, also process your HD2 and your HD3 and make some streams, right?
Correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. And isn't there an AM version of the Omnia 9 as well?
There is. So, okay. So it's in it, you know, you sort of have to pick your flavor when you buy one, right? You order it for whatever you want, and that's it can be a single FM plus every one of them comes with an FM and HD1 because, you know, of iBock in the United States, that's the same program content. So you get HD and you get a stream and you get some studio processing with it. You get streaming processing and a streaming encoder with the 9.
Yeah. Then there are some options. You can buy an RDS license probably to.
Yeah, you can buy RDS. You can buy HD2 and HD3 paths. Okay. Or if you want to process your secondary and tertiary channels, you can do two FMs simultaneously.
Really?
You can
composite
FMs if you want.
Okay.
And you can do an HD1 and a stream with each of those. But you know, there's only so much you can do in one box on one chip. So when you do the double FM, dual FM mode, you can't do the HD2 and 3. So there's some trade-offs there. FM and AM at the same time. You could just do AM if you want. But you get simultaneous AM and FM as long as the AM and FM are co-located.
It sounds a little complicated. Probably better talk to a salesperson. And by the way, I want to point out, yes, both of us work for Telos. We are both familiar with Omnia gear, this isn't intended to be an hour-long commercial. We're really, you know, Jim is a great teacher at teaching principles. So we're using an Omnia platform to teach the principles, but we're going to hear about the these principles. One more thing you can get, and that is becoming somewhat popular, and that is the micro MPX encoder. So you can send FM composite at a reasonable bit rate over the public internet if you want to.
Correct. You sure can. You can send it point to point. The micro MPX is an encode decode process. Mm-hmm. So you can get the Omnia 9 with a built-in micro MPX encoder and then decode it on the other end. There's a variety of ways you can decode it on the other side, but you can actually encode the micro MPX as an option in the 9.
I'm actually getting ready to do that. When I can get to American Samoa, they have a travel ban right now, but when I can get back to American Samoa, we're putting all our audio processing at the transmitter, excuse me, at the mm-hmm. studio site mm-hmm. and using micro MPX to the transmitter. Right now we do live wire over IP radio, and that's mm-hmm. great, except there's no backup for me. Public internet won't carry live wire. The backup IP radios we have won't carry live wire. They were gifted to us or provided by FEMA because we're the LP1 station, but I want something that I can send not only over our main IP link, but I can also have backup, and that's going to be micro MPX. So I've got them ready to go here in my office. I just can't get to Samoa.
Can't get there. Well, and it sort of solves, you know, when we were developing the 9, it's sort of been dubbed like the Swiss Army knife of processors as well, because you can do multiple HDs, you can do multiple streams and everything, you know, but we often, and this is processor agnostic. If you can get the composite signal at the transmitter, this is why we put audio processors at the transmitter, because you can take a piece of coax and run it out of the composite of your processor right into the exciter, or use Omnia Direct, the AES-192. You want that composite. You know, you can get a little bit louder. You get that, you know, if the composite domain, you got no overshoots in the STLs. The real place, the right place for an FM processor, ideally, is at the transmitter. We've had, you know, before you had internet connectivity as it's sort of a thing at transmitter sites, that always meant a trip to the transmitter. So if you had to, you know, something to adjust the processing out to the transmitter. One of the sort of Achilles heels or the decisions that customers had to make with a 9 was, well, if I put it at the transmitter site, I get the most goody out of the FM back end on the composite side of it. But now my exporters, where, you know, how do I do my HD 2 and 3? How do I do my streams? Do I backhaul them to the studio? Do I put – so there's all these decisions and trade-offs, right, that you – micro MPX gets you around that. You know, you can now put the processor at the studio where it's easy to adjust. You can remote into it. You can walk up to it. You can do your multiple HDs. Your streaming encoders are probably, or streaming servers are probably at the studio anyway and not at the transmitter site. Everything's right there in the studio. The composite goes micro MPX and gets decoded on the other end. So it solves a number of challenges.
Let us, I appreciate all the preamble and the discussion of kind of where things can go. Mm-hmm. I think we better jump right into this because we got a lot to cover. You have this software, and let's bring it up on the screen right here. I'll make it full screen in just a minute. Okay. I've seen this before. I know what it is, but this looks so fancy. What software are we looking at here?
This is a piece of software called NF Remote. The NF, by the here's a trivia question, stands for New Framework. When Leif Claesson was designing this, he wanted to start from scratch with a brand new remote interface. And he had multiple products in mind at the time. He wanted to be able to use this for linear acoustic television. He wanted to be able to use it for the Omnia processors, for his own breakaway processors. And so NF is New Framework, and it is a Windows-based application, standalone app that you install, and it facilitates the connectivity between your PC and your Omnia 9 hardware.
A couple things I'd like to point out about this, because I had these questions and I found the answers to them. First of all, it's a Windows app because mm-hmm. high performance is desired for this app. This app is extraordinarily accurate. It's precise and it's accurate.
It is. If
you have a good enough IP connection between where you are running this app and mm-hmm. the audio processor, whether it's mm-hmm. that processor is running in software, whether it's a hardware Omnia 9 processor, an enormous amount of data can be shared with the app, and you can even listen to the audio at various places in the processor, and you can hear it linearly if you have a good enough IP connection.
Correct.
Which is amazing. And if you don't have a good enough IP connection, the software automatically scales mm-hmm. to give you somewhat lossy audio, right? And if you're watching a fancy, fancy multi-page screen here, and you don't have enough bandwidth, it will selectively start to reduce that just to the essential elements. So no matter what bandwidth you have, I mean, north of a dial-up modem, you're going to get some meaningful display. And if you've got great bandwidth, it's just like being there.
Yeah. And the feature that you're talking about is something called client audio. And client audio basically lets you stream back. And I say stream, I'm not talking about an encoded stream, streaming audio as we normally talk about it. But it actually sends audio back from the processor itself to the computer running NF remote. And you can hear, it's really nice. You can sit at a remote location, whether that's in your car or wherever you can connect, and you can actually adjust your processing real time remotely. And if you have the bandwidth, it does it, like you said, in an uncompressed format, and then it'll start compressing and it at least gives you something. And you can listen to dozens of patch points along the way, inputs, outputs, various points in the processing. You want to hear just the output of the wideband? You want to hear just the output of the multiband? How about one band of the multiband? You just want to hear the bass clipper? It's all, and that's good for troubleshooting. So, because if you hear something in your audio and, maybe you hear a little hole punching or a little wideband ducking or something, and you're like, all right, what do I need to adjust to get rid of that? Where is that coming from? The client audio feature is really nice for isolating and, I don't hear it here. I don't hear it here. Oh, now I hear it. So you can kind of troubleshoot, backwards through the path and figure out where things might need to be tweaked and adjusted.
Tell you what, let's spend another minute or two talking about this remote access software, and then we're going to take a quick break from one of our terrific sponsors, and then we'll be back to dive deep into setting this up and making processing adjustments, based on what the features are here. I recall, Jim, that you've got a couple of options as to how to actually connect yourself to your processor for remote control of it. You can IP directionally into it, but you can also have it call out to you. How does that work?
Correct. So you can and this is really good for
the outbound connection.
Right. So I can always connect. If I know the IP address of the processor and I'm on the same subnet and can get to the processor from my PC, then I can always connect to it. And multiple people, by the way, can connect to one unit at once, so you can collaborate, and one person can connect to multiple processors at the same time as well. But the outbound connection, if I open up, tell you what port I'm on and give you my IP address, you can actually, without having to go through the, like a remote, my PC or any remote connection or anything like that, or VPNing in, you can actually connect sort of backwards, which is really nice for support. So, if you call up our support team and you, because a lot of network security is kind of a big thing. And sure, if you're working for one of the larger broadcasters and the IT department is not the engineering department necessarily, back when it was one guy and he was doing all of the engineering and the IT, it was okay. But there's corporate policies, and for good reason, they don't want you tunneling through and opening up ports and everything. So the outbound connection kind of gives you a way to work backwards, which is really nice if you're connecting to the support guys.
I'll also say that, this display is pretty, and there is a mode where you can make it all display. So you have up to 8 windows that you can put in there, and you're not even showing them all here, but you have things like an FFT display that shows the FM baseband. Mm-hmm. You can size these things bigger, smaller. And my point is this, you can, if you want to, let's say that you have a big color display in your engineering office or in the station lobby. Yep. You can have this thing come up full screen, bam, and you've got these beautiful, amazing displays. And it just, I mean, for an engineer, it makes your socks roll up and down.
It is good eye candy. It perks your pocket protector right up. Absolutely.
All right. So we know a little bit about this software and how to connect to it. There's so much more to tell about it, but this is supposed to be a tutorial on processing. So, Jim Kuzman, we're going to be back in just a couple minutes here, to take this deep dive. And Jim Kuzman is the expert here. He wrote the book, literally did, the manual for the Omnia 9 and other similar processors from Leif Claisen. So we'll be right back. You're watching This Week in Radio Tech, episode 532 with Jim Kuzman, and I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Phil from Broadcast Bionics in the UK, and we've been helping broadcasters and podcasters to work remotely for some time. But in 2020, this has become more of a necessity for many. X-Screen, Bionic Studio, and our other products can be fully functional via the internet on a VPN connection or RDP session. If you have any type of Telos VX, HX6 or IQ6, you may already be using the free edition of X-Screen 2, giving you a software interface to go alongside your VSET controller. The subscription edition not only adds a cloud database and unrestricted workstation licenses, but also allows the user to call screen using a USB headset. Bionic Talk Show, part of the Bionic Studio, also allows this. Up until now, it's mainly been used for remote broadcasts, but now more and more stations have call screeners and producers working from home or socially distanced offices. The teams can still collaborate, communicate, and deliver programming with the help of our tools. Many routers will have a VPN option. Your local IT specialist can help with this. Using a VPN, our workstation client software can be run on a home PC or laptop as if it was running on a machine in the studio. With remote desktop, the software still runs on a PC at the station. Simple port forwarding on your router may be all that's required to then control that PC and deliver the headset audio from another device using RDP, which is available as part of Windows. For technical help, our support team are on hand. You can email them on support@bionics.co.uk. Combined with our Anywhere and Skype TX for Radio products, broadcast quality audio can be delivered from contributors around the corner or around the globe. They can even instant message with the shared chat windows and see the now playing information from within the Anywhere remote web interface. For more information, go to bionic.radio.
Really cool stuff from Broadcast Bionics, our good friends over in England. And their software is in the biggest radio stations around the world, especially in England, but they're becoming more and more everywhere else around the world. So check them out at bionic.radio, bionic.radio. Represented in the U.S. by Broadcasters General Store. I just used some Bionic software last week for a major corporate production, and it worked fabulously. And quick to train other people, too. So check it out at bionic.radio. All right, it's Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. And we are talking to Jim Kuzman. Jim's my colleague at Telos, but he also knows all about Omnia audio processing, especially the Omnia 9. He wrote the book. And let's see, I need to click the right button here to bring Jim back in. Jim, we're looking at this NF remote software, mm-hmm. and I think I'm ready to shut up and let you take us on a tour of what we should know, again, with an eye toward learning about audio processing, but also using examples in the Omnia 9 processor itself to help learn about those things. So,
yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier, you know, it looks overwhelmingly complicated. You know, it's one of those, you know, with flexibility comes complexity kind of thing. But you don't have to look at it all at once. You can, just because it's there doesn't mean you have to look at it, doesn't mean you have to use it. So it is a little intimidating at first, but you quickly get used to it. And the displays in NF remote are really very highly configurable. Anytime you click in one of these, any of the boxes, the display menu comes up. And you can see in the lower left portion there, you've got main meters, loudness, modulation, instrumentation. So you can put any of these meters to the degree that your screen has real estate and see what you want to see. You can turn things off. You can turn, you know, if you want to see the undo processing, which we'll talk about in a minute, you can turn that on. If you just want to see the processing meters, you don't want to see anything else, well, you can turn that off too. And the displays in NF remote are sort of dynamically resized when you know, if I want to make this window a little bit smaller, you know, I can make it smaller and, you know, things start to shift around and it dynamically resizes. And the same thing with these little grab handles over here. You've got three sections, a top, middle, and a bottom. And if I want to devote more real estate to the center buttons, well, I can do that. If I want more real estate down with the controls, I can do that. If I'm okay with smaller controls and I really want to see the meters in bigger, then I can resize. And you can do that with any of six display presets up here in the right-hand corner. So you can set them up any way you want to. This one I have set up for RTAs for each of the bands. So,
oh, wow.
You know, when you're adjusting processing, sometimes it's, you don't know, you know, which, you know, in your head you can hear, well, you know, it's a little too warm in the 200, 250 hertz range. You know, I kind of want to dip maybe the male vocals a little bit. Mm-hmm. Well, which band is that? Well, if you set the RTAs up to look at the output of each of the bands, you can see which band and you can make your adjustments. So
one of my favorite thing, well, I love the eye candy of the FFT. I don't know if you can pop one of those up real quick, but the there you go. So you've got your left plus right, your pilot, left minus right. And if you've got RDS turned on, the RDS shows up there as well.
It does. So I've got these set up to look at the composite inputs as well, but you can turn those off. So I'm looking at my left plus right, my left minus right, you know, my side bands. There's the pilot in the middle. And if I had RDS turned on, which I can do here.
There you go.
There's your RDS. I'm just using the internal generator.
Yeah, that can be internal or external. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I find really helpful, especially because I use this for stream processing as well, built into the ZipStream 9X2 software. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's the time graph of loudness, and I run two of them. I run one of them with the input audio over time, so I can see if there's a song that's really low or some source that's really, really hot. There you go. There's a time graph.
So there's the short-term version, and then there's a momentary version as well. And you can pick the patch point. So this is the input, but if I want to look at the composite output, which can be a little tighter, then I can do that. And I can see it over time. I've got my decimals on the vertical scale and time on the horizontal scale. So, yeah, it really shows you how loud and how dense your processing is, how much, you know, how big or little the, you know, you're squeezing things.
Over time. So I just wanted to mention a couple things that I like. There's oscilloscope and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. But if this, I guess you want to start at the audio input and tell us what's available there when you bring audio in.
Yeah. So when you bring the audio in, the first processing stage, I mean, you've got what we call undo. And, you know, you've heard a lot about the perfect declipper from Hans von Zipfen. And that's in the Omnia 11 processor, and it's also in the Omnia 9. The 9 takes it a little bit further, and it not only has the perfect declipper, but it also has a multiband expander. So the perfect declipper tries to recreate or rebuild peaks that were lost during the mastering process if the peaks get clipped. You know, there's no bringing that back. Once something's clipped, you know that it's gone, and it's gone forever. The best we can do is try to remanufacture what the original peak was. So that's what the perfect declipper does. The multiband expanders take that a little bit further because there's also a tendency in mastering to really dynamically compress things, which, of course, we do when we are processing for particularly for FM. You know, there's not a whole lot of dynamic range left because, you know, most people want to be competitively loud. And one of the ways to do that is to give up dynamic range. But the material that's coming in the last 10, 15 years is already so dynamically compressed, there's no life left in it. And so what the multiband expanders do is they actually restore some of the dynamic range. And of course, the first question is, why would you bother restoring dynamic range when all you're going to do is crush the audio in the FM domain anyway? It goes back to the old garbage in, garbage out. We want to process it our way. We don't want to start with the sausage. We want to make our own sausage at the end. So, you know, content music that is open and dynamic and has some life into it survives the processing much better, because FM's pretty brutal. You know, not only are you doing your, you know, wide and multiband compression limiting and AGCs, but you also have the pre-emphasis curve. That's pretty rough. You've got, you know, final peak limiters at the end. You've got clipping at the end. It's a rough trip for a signal to get through an FM path, you know, as far as the audio quality goes. So, those two stages of the undo processing really help.
I want to put in a plug for the undo based on things like if you're, let's say, a country radio station and you have if you just compare a George Strait song from the late 1980s, it'll be fairly open and dynamic versus a George Strait song from the late 1990s or early 2000s, which is just wall of sound. Mm-hmm. These are going to sound very different, and it's hard to set processing that's going to make them each sound good. Yeah. We're talking about classic country. We're not talking about different formats of stations. We're talking about one format of station, yep. Classic country with yep. very different sounds. Yep. And the Undo will take that wall of sound George Strait song from the early 2000s and relax that a lot, so we can then apply the same processing to anything that comes in.
Correct.
If you're playing heavy metal, if you're playing, if you're playing oldies and you got a song that's a Phil Spector wall of sound, mm-hmm. Compared to something by Gordon Lightfoot,
yep.
Well, this helps those sound more like what you want.
It does.
Song to song to song.
It does. And it doesn't hurt anything that doesn't need it. So there's an intelligence there.
You go.
If it doesn't need the declipper, if it doesn't need the multiband expander, you can leave them turned on and turned up if you want to, because if it doesn't require, their corrective, process, then, it just doesn't do anything at all. So there's no downside. Really.
I'll say one more nice thing about this. I do use this processing on the stream and on the air too, but I can't hear it on the air on my mm-hmm. station in Hawaii. And so I've got it on a Wi-Fi radio out in the hallway. It wafts in here all day long, and the songs just sound so consistent. And we play songs from the 80s, 90s, and today. So, yep. There's a quite a variety in the processing from the mastered songs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And their sound from their producer. And it just sounds so consistent, so pleasant all day long on the stream.
It's good for formats like that, or, that span country, or jack formats that span, and oldies, yeah. Oldies isn't what oldies was when I was, starting out in radio.
I know.
The stuff that I grew up listening to is now oldies, which is really, that makes you want to go in the corner and curl up. But, the recording techniques have really changed. The Nashville sound, country was so clean once upon a time. It was the last holdout. They held out for a long time.
Yeah.
So did contemporary Christian. Those were really well crafted songs.
Hmm.
And, then they kind of had to follow suit. And a lot of times the mastering engineers don't want to do this. This isn't always what they want their product to sound like. But somebody's writing them a check, the artist or the label yeah. or something wants a certain sound and a texture. And that's what they deliver. But
they're also mastering these songs to sound loud on an otherwise linear playout system, that mm-hmm. being a CD or I realize AAC music files aren't linear exactly, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
In other words, they're not going through a processor afterwards, and there's no preemphasis to deal with. So what may come out of a mastering place for loudness mm-hmm. is not what we want for FM.
Correct.
And so we want to undo what they did and do it our own way.
Right. And I've had people ask me, they're like, why would you want to do that in the processor? That's not the right place to do it. Well, it's not. It really isn't. I mean, but this is, the right place to do it is when you're doing the recording and the mastering. We don't take any pleasure in having to do this, but in the absence of anybody else doing it, and even if the industry changed today and tastes changed today, we're going to have 20 years worth of music that's pretty darn crushed before it even gets to air. And it's not like anybody's going to stop playing it anytime soon.
I was talking to a program director at a contemporary Christian station here in Nashville, and he told me that they actually do have access to unprocessed versions of the hit songs.
Yes, I knew of a station, and I won't say who they are, but their ratings and their notoriety let them sort of have enough authority, shall we say, that when they got something, and they were very, very audio conscious, very good ears, and mm-hmm. very quality oriented, and they would say, nope, we're just not going to play it. You got to send us something that sounds better than this, and they did. So.
Thinking about this Undo, and I know you can listen to lots of different points. Are there mm-hmm. any points of listening in an Omnia 9 processor to points of Undo
yeah.
that give you an idea of what it's undoing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh. Now, I know we can't hear it here, but tell us what's available.
Right. So if we, I'm going to the monitor outputs menu here, and I can actually look at all of these patch points. Here's the FM. I can look at physical inputs and outputs. I can also look at undo. So I can or listen to it. If I turn this audio on here, on my computer that's running NF remote. This would play back through whatever audio device I selected. You know, it could be my built-in speakers or the output of a sound card or whatever, my headphones. And by selecting pre-declipper, I can actually hear the input audio, the equivalent of the input audio. This is before anything's done. I can listen to it after it's been declipped, but before it's been expanded. And then at the undo output, I'm listening to the declipper and the multiband expander. So I've got three patch points within undo where I can listen to the effects of it. And I can also set up oscilloscopes to look at those patch points as well. So I can actually see the clipped audio get declipped, and I can see the crushed audio get expanded.
Now, I take it that there are the presets that come in a processor like this. Mm-hmm. Some of those presets already include proper presets or for the undo function.
Yes. Right? Yes. Almost all of the factory presets. In fact, I think all of them use undo. Undo is turned on by default.
Okay.
If you want to turn off undo, you can't. You don't have to use undo. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you're, you know, if you're playing classical music, if you're playing, you know, all stuff that's from 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s or whatever, you know, there's not a whole lot of upside. There's not much to do with that material. So you can actually go into undo and bypass the whole thing and just turn it off. And you'll see some of the multiband expander meters kind of gray out there. They get to a more dull color, and then they turn back on, they get bright. I can turn on the declipper, I can turn off the declipper, or just the expanders. So I can do both.
Okay.
You don't have to use it, but the presets, all the factory presets come with it turned on by default.
Undo to me, undo and declipper. These are well, some years ago you would call them a secret weapon. Because they can make your station sound like no other. Now, if everybody else is using this kind of processing with undo and declipping, then that starts to put you back on an even playing field with the other stations. But this is so critical, and I know that it helps so that the next thing we do in the processing really becomes ours, and it's not so much at the whim of the record producer, which may have been under – who may have been under other constraints.
Right. Exactly.
So you want to move on to multiband? We've got a few minutes before we take another break. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to turn this off so we can see the meters
in a little more
detail there. There's a lot of information here. We can see the input meters. These are ITU 1770 loudness meters at the input. So you can see what your input levels are doing. Mm-hmm. There's an auto balance meter. This is kind of a neat thing. Probably more of a problem in an analog plant than it is in a modern live wire or AS67 digital plant.
Right.
But things get out of whack side to side sometimes. We've both been in the business long enough to, know that you have to go through and get the left and right correct. But sometimes sources drift, and sometimes source material is recorded, a little wonky side to side. So the auto balance, if you turn that on, will actually dynamically raise and lower the left and right input channels to make sure that both are driven.
It won't chase a Beatles song left to right, will it? It's a little slower.
If you want it to, it will.
Okay.
All right. It's you could. But when you turn auto balance on, you've got several controls. You've got a range. So you can say, don't do more than 2 dB of correction or 4 dB. You've got an integration time. So this is the time it waits before it's actually starting to make the move. And then you have a channel loss timeout that's part of this as well. So it'll actually bring a backup audio source on. If you have a song, Norwegian Wood, which is, starts with the guitar in the right channel, or Pearl Jam's Alive, which starts with guitar, those only last 5 or 6 seconds. This isn't going to do anything. I've got this set to 10 seconds. It's not going to do anything for 10 seconds. If you take something like Al Stewart's Year of the Cat, it's left channel piano only for 35 seconds.
Mm.
Well, at this point, if there was any audio in the right channel at all that was above the threshold of the processors where it's going to start to bring it up, it's going to start bringing it up. Right. There's nothing to bring up in that particular recording. It's dead silence. So there's really no harm there. But you do have to be cognizant of the source material because you don't want to start. Yeah. You don't want to start playing with the Beatles. That's just bad karma, I think.
One of the things I like about auto balance is that with FM transmission, unless you're looking for a particular effect, you don't want to increase the left minus right, because that tends to give you more multipath or more effects of multipath. Mm-hmm. So if there's just a little mistake in the dubbing, or again, if you have an analog plant and, mm-hmm. and that's easy to have a slight, you know, a 1 or 2 or 3 dB imbalance. Mm-hmm. If you're not careful, a pot gets dirty on a distribution amp, something like that. Mm-hmm. First of all, let's get rid of those if we possibly can.
Yes,
but,
please.
but if you can't, that auto balance, if you can keep the L minus R from being artificially increased,
right,
then you're better off with your transmission overall. What are these stereo expander looking things?
Yeah, so we've got a stereo enhancer, and in the 9, it's a multiband enhancer. So it actually it doesn't do anything with the lowest two bands, because there's really no in the lower frequencies, there's we don't really hear a difference in the left and right channels, even if there's one there. So it takes the highest five bands, and it will. I'm going to move over real quick here to so I can make some adjustments in this. In the stereo expanders, mm-hmm. or enhancers, when we see the yellow coming in from the center and going to the outside, that means it's widening that material in that band. You can also reduce the amount, and you'll see some red meters starting to come in from the sides if we do that. So, you know, like you had mentioned, some stereo enhancement is often nice, but you don't want to, you know, why expand something that's already really wide? You don't want to exaggerate that. You take that to a level, and you know the vocal, you get karaoke. It starts to turn itself inside out, not to mention, you know, the possible effects of multipath. So we've also got a setting in here where you can bring that in a little bit too. So if stuff is too wide, you can start to narrow that a little bit. So what it does is gives you a very consistent stereo sound field.
There are stations that are in extraordinarily mountainous areas, and multipath is a big problem for them. And I've known 100 kilowatt FM station in Eastern Kentucky that operates in mono, just so they can hit people that live in the hills and hollers.
Yep.
You could, instead of taking that drastic a measure, you could reduce your stereo width and keep it within some constraints. You'd still get a stereo effect, mm-hmm. but it would be limited to what you want, because this will also do. I didn't know that. I found that out just now.
Yeah. So I can actually, you know, you've got a target width controls here per band, but, you know, if I want to really narrow that down, I can start doing more, narrowing of that than I am expanding. And again, it's dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I can control, you know, to what degree too. You know, if I only want to do a couple of dB, I can do that. If I want to do a whole lot of it, I can do more. But what this is doing, and it's always chasing a target. So if you need to, you know, keep that a little more in check, if you're in a mountainous area or you're trying to not to do too much left minus right, mm-hmm. and exacerbate a multipath problem, then you can narrow it here as well. It's still stereo. There's still separation.
Yeah.
But you've got a lot more control over what, you know, where that target is, and it's always chasing that target.
You know, just 8 or 10 dB of actual stereo separation is fine for most people in most environments.
Oh, yeah. If you're listening in the car, I mean, that sounds plenty wide.
Let's hit the AG, the wideband AGC, and then we're going to take a quick break and come back and look at the rest of this extreme. This is probably one of the most important functions in the process.
It is.
But what's the AGC?
So the AGC, in the configuration that we're in now, it's a horizontal bar graph. It'll go vertical in certain, you know, as you resize the windows. But input AGC is really important, obviously, because you've got, varying levels coming in. So you've got board ops that are more or less careful. You've got songs that are hotter than others. You've got commercials that are cut. All the reasons that you need a good AGC. But it also puts your multiband in a sweet spot too. You get to control how much drive and how much gain reduction you've got going in the multiband. So it really is probably one of the most important stages of processing. And it's probably one of the hardest to get right from an algorithm standpoint and from an adjustment standpoint. And for a long time, the benchmark pre-processing AGC was the AFX compeller. And one of the tricks the compeller had up its sleeve was it was a compressor and it was a leveler. That's how they got the name, compeller. It's compressor leveler. So it's a clever combination of those two things. So you have a compressor that's running with pretty low ratios, but at a faster attack and release time. And then you've got a leveler that's running in a sort of in a parallel path to that in the compeller, where you've got a really tight ratio, but you've got very slow time constants. And the balance between that made it more of a compressor or more of a leveler. This isn't working in exactly the same way, but one of the challenges is if I run this slow enough that it doesn't become intrusive or introduce audible artifacts, it's really not all that effective. Mm-hmm. If I run it fast enough to get the kind of wideband gain control that I need, well, now I've got a lot of wideband, and that comes with its own set of compromises and artifacts. We've all heard the pumping and ducking, and
The
noise gets sucked up when levels go down, so it's easy to get a wideband AGC to misbehave. The way the 9 works around that is it's input AGC, and this is all settable. This is all per preset. You can change every parameter about all of this stuff. But the way it was sort of meant to be used and the way most presets run is you use a tighter AGC and slower time constant. You can see this really isn't moving very much, but it's running a pretty tight ratio. And then on top of that, we can introduce a second, and I'm going to exaggerate these controls just so you can sort of see it working.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But now if you look, we've got this orange bar that comes out of there. So we've got a leveler here in the input AGC, and then we've got a compressor on top of it.
Okay.
So if I get a song that comes along, you know, I'm just kind of cruising along, and then I get a song that's really loud, this will step in until the input AGC catches up, and then it starts to back out again, and it gets out of the way.
Okay.
So it's sort of a two-stage stacked wideband approach.
Okay. So the leveler over time keeps in the right place, but you've got this AGC that can jump in there and say, hey, whoa, slow down there, Hoss.
Correct.
Okay.
And it's one of the easiest places to go into the weeds. Of all the silly things in a processor this complicated, this wideband AGC 1 can get you in the most trouble. Because as you can see, if we were to listen to this now with these settings, at these speeds and this much gain reduction, you would hear this working.
Yeah. Okay?
It's meant to be used very subtly. And, you know, pick your favorite test track for doing wideband AGC. But set properly, it's completely transparent.
Gotcha. Good deal. Jim, we have been through part of the processor. We've got about the second half to go and some cool things toward the end of it. So we are going to take a quick break now and hear from one of our sponsors. So stand by. In fact, Jim used to wire studios, so you probably have a little bit of interest in what we're about to point out here. And that is the Henry Superlight. I'll go ahead and keep us both on the screen here. Here's an example of what it is. You can see me in the little screen there. This is the little Henry Superlight. We know that Henry Engineering makes boxes that just help us get things done. You know, one time I had to wire two studios, and I had one Henry Super Relay, and I didn't have another one. And so I had to lash up my own relay, and this was in American Samoa, so parts were a little hard to come by. And I got to tell you, it was ugly. It was ugly. Ugly, bad, ugly. I hate to think about how ugly that situation was. But the Henry Superlight, how is it different from the Henry Super Relay? Well, we know the Henry Super Relay, it's got a power cord on it. You plug it in. It's got a power socket on it, and it's got inputs for contact closures, either sustained or momentary, and it would flash your output. It'd give you a flashing output or a steady output, and it would also give you lots of auxiliary contacts. What did you use yours for? We would start and stop cassette motors that were doing air checks, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Telescoped air checks. Well, the Superlight is similar in some ways and better in others. The Superlight doesn't run your 110-volt light that's above the door. It runs your LED lights. So many lights nowadays are LED based, including the lights that are, say, on the microphone, on the little microphone ring. Some of those have that, or lights in the studio. You may want to just light up a whole bank of LEDs to let people know they're on the air. Or some of these new furniture consoles have strips of LED lights in them, and you want them to be one color when the mic is off and switch to red when the mic is on. All different possibilities. Well, the Superlight from Henry can help you get all that done. The Superlight, let me get you full screen here. It is a logic control interface for controlling low voltage audio studio tally lights. It can directly power 12 volt DC LED tally lights that draw up to half an amp. The Superlight includes a flasher circuit, just like the old Super Relay did, as well as a double pole, double throw relay output. So you can get normally closed contacts and normally open contacts with a double pull, double throw. And you can, all the control and relay outputs and LED output connections are via the plug-in Euroblock connectors. Those work really well. They make wiring fast. You get two RJ45 connectors, and you say, well, what are those for? They are so you can daisy chain one super light to another over what Henry calls control link I/O. So you can daisy chain some of these together, which is really convenient if you've got several studios. Here's an example on their webpage. You can see a single studio with a super light, and you can also do multi-studio and just jumper one to another, and you set the jumpers inside. Hey, this is for studio B, this is for studio C and studio D. You can do that up to I think six or eight. It's a really cool way to get that done. So check that out. The Henry Superlight. It's the modern way to handle this kind of light switching. You can, if you need to mute speakers, of course you can mute speakers through the double throw, double pole, double throw contacts in there. Mm-hmm. You can mute a phone if you need to. So you got a phone that, you know, is obnoxious when the mic is off. Well, you can make it silent when the mic is on. And of course, where do you get the Henry Superlight? You get it from Broadcasters General Store. They have the entire range of Henry products there. And Henry Engineering makes just so many good things. Even in modern studios where you've got audio over IP, where you've got a lot less cabling than we ever had before, you still need a few doodads to make things happen around the studios, up and down the hallways, in the rack room, maybe even give flashing lights at the front desk, secretary's desk, whatever. Henry Engineering can really help you out with that. And the super light is a great, great way to do it. Thanks a lot, Henry, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Jim Kuzman, my colleague at the Telos Alliance. And Jim, we're going to dive right back into this. Let's see. There we go. Oh, you've got some happening audio here now.
There's some things happening. Yeah.
All right.
Kirk, I'm impressed. Yeah. It took you, 11 years and 532 episodes to run out of knowledgeable, interesting people and to bring us to the point we're at today. So that's a long run, buddy.
Well, Jim, I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time, and we did a little thing internally with Telos it became clear we need to have Jim on to explain this stuff. All right, I understand, Jim, that the Omnia 9, as a few other processors on the market, you can select the number of bands in the multiband processing.
Yeah.
First of all, if you spend 20, 30 seconds on why do we want multiband processing in the first place, and then how do we pick how many bands we want to use?
Sure. Well, multiband processing is desirable for a couple of reasons. It slices up the audio spectrum into more than one band as opposed to wideband, you know, like we just looked at. The trouble with wideband processing is that whatever frequency has the most energy is in the driver's seat. So it's very easy if you get a big bass hit and, you know, it wants to turn the gain down. And then you get, you know, things like hole punching and ducking and things like that. So one of the reasons to have multiband is to make sure that the entire audio spectrum isn't under the control of any particular range of frequencies. The other reason multiband is nice is because it gives you what we call the audio signature, you know, the custom sound of a station, basically a dynamic EQ curve. You know, stations are always looking for a unique sound. So multiband lets you, bring up the bass or bring up the highs or bring down the mids or create whatever output curve you want spectrally. And it does so in a dynamic way. So it's changing the gain in multiple bands. And in the Omnia 9, you get to pick anywhere between 3 and 7 bands of multiband processing. So if we take a look at like the classical and jazz preset, let's see here. I'll pull up classical. Got too many presets in here. Here's one for 3-band jazz. All right, so in classical music, you know, the classical audience, they know what the recordings sound like, right? They've been to the live performance. They probably own whatever it is you're playing on CD because they're a very educated and very passionate audience. And they don't want you messing with the spectrum of their favorite recording of whatever, you know, classical piece it is. So with classical and with jazz, the goal is usually to sort of more honor the artistic intent and the spectral balance of the original recording. So fewer bands let you do that. More bands gives you more consistency. So the finer you slice the pie, the more control you have over how consistent the sound is. Hmm. I will say if we go back to the preset we were on, you can take these, an existing preset. And if you go to the multi-band setup menu, you can take bands away. Fly.
All right.
So you can take this all the way down to three bands if you want to. And the crossovers change dynamically as you go. Mm-hmm. We had this, the RTA up here a minute ago. Well, now we're only looking at three bands. So that first band is from, you know, 20 hertz all the way up to, you know, 500 some hertz. And you can see how wide the crossovers are in this case.
Yeah.
And as you add more bands, you know, the crossovers get a little bit narrower and, you can see this RTA kind of fill in there. But because the crossovers change, the sound of the processor in the multiband section changes as well. Everybody thinks more is better. More is more consistent mm-hmm. because you've got more bands, but more isn't necessarily more pleasing with some formats. Personally, and of course, processing is very, very subjective. There's sure, no right or wrong sure. answer. You know, it's whatever your market and your ears dictate and your format. But I find that sometimes five bands or six bands, particularly on female vocals, moves the crossovers just a little bit and makes female vocals a little bit more smoother and less peaky sounding than they would be on a seven band preset. So, you know, even if you find a preset that you like, and you, don't be afraid to play around, you know, take a couple of bands away or add a couple of bands and see what happens. You can always go back.
And by the way, there's nothing that says that I use three bands on most of my streams. Mm-hmm. I don't need my streams to be just a wall of sound. I need them to be, over time, consistently the same volume.
Sure. Yep.
But I don't need for them to jump out of the she who shall not be named,
yes.
the speaker of the house.
And, <You're right.
laughs> yeah, and so, yeah, for me, for most of my streams, three band is just fine. I got a couple of hyped up streams that you know use something much, much more aggressive. Mm-hmm. Okay. On the multibands, I keep seeing these red bars come down from the yellow, and I understand that limiting is also kind of part and parcel to this architecture here.
Correct. So in other Omnia processors, you know, the Omnia Volt, the Omnia 11, the multiband AGC section is sort of independent, and then the multiband limiting section is an entirely different architecture. It may have a different number of bands. The crossovers are in different places. It sort of lives on its own, and it really doesn't have a direct tie to the multiband compressors or AGC before it. In the 9, Leif took a little bit of a different approach, and each one of the bands has a peak limiter that sits on top of it. So the crossovers for the limiters are the same as the crossovers for the multiband AGC. You do have control over the thresholds. So, you know, you can take the limiters and run them harder per band or overall, or you can take the limiters out of the equation altogether, just about. But you'll always see those red bars come down, and that means there's an instantaneous peak limiter happening on that particular band. That's what the bright red is.
When the outputs of these bands are mixed back together for the mm-hmm. purpose of the final limiting or clipping, mm-hmm. Isn't it important that their output levels be pretty similar to each other so that one band isn't consistently clipped more than another? And if so, how does that get accomplished in adjustment of this?
Right. So with the output, there's if you're familiar, if you go back to the original Omnia, the FM, the Omnia 6, the Volt, the Omnia 11, you'll have a mix control at the output of the multiband AGCs, mm-hmm. and then you'll have another mix control at the output of the limiters, so that you have some control over what's being driven into the next stage. that is missing from the nine in the multiband section, because, or from the multiband AGCs, because the AGCs and the limiters are stacked on top of each other. But you still have a band mix section, just like you would in any other processor, that lets you sort of do the last final bit of spectral sculpting before you get to whatever the next stage is. In the FM mode, it's a clipper. In the HD mode or the stream, it would be a look ahead limiter. So you still have those, but that's anytime you make adjustments, I always make adjustments downward in the mix levels. I don't like to make adjustments upward unless I'm trying to create an effect. You know, if I'm trying to drive the bass clipper harder, then I might up the mix level a little bit here. But I've got a bass clipper threshold control for that. So I tend to go backwards on these and not use them as a boost, because the only safety net you have after this is whatever your final peak control stage is for the mode that you're in. Well,
I would think that if you take a band and mix it with the others hotter at this point, it's kind of like a dandelion growing in your yard. It's the first thing the lawnmower is going to whack.
It absolutely is. And so, there's a price to pay. You know, processing is always, there's always a compromise, right? And the goal is to try to, is to minimize those compromises and make them as inaudible as possible.
Yeah.
But at this stage of the game, when you're this far down in the processing path, this is going to have the most profound effect on the texture and the distortion loudness trade-off too.
Unfortunately, we're going to be running out of time before too long, but I want to ask you, why does this processor, as well as some others I've seen, have separate bass clippers and a main clipper? Is that what's going on here?
That's what's going on here. So you see the bass clipper meters here, and then you see the main clipper meters. If bass has the most energy, and this is why, you know, if you're talking linear audio, you know, to really deliver a thunderous low end through a PA system requires exponentially more wattage than mids and highs do. The same is true in an audio spectrum as far as audio processing and RF goes. The bass is expensive, you know, it's heavy and it's costly, and it can do the most damage because it's got the most energy. So if we didn't have a bass clipper and we were just throwing everything at the final clipper, it would be responding to the bass energy. And that's a short path to dirtying up the sound for sure, creating inner mod and clipping distortion, all sorts of other nastiness that we work really, really hard to try to avoid.
Yeah. Okay.
So by having a bass clipper in there, you've separated. It's sort of like the multi-band approach to processing, except in the clipping section, so that we can deal with the bass separately and not have it pollute the rest of the spectrum and overwork the main clipper.
If I'm processing here for FM and my HD1, which is exactly the same programming, is there a point here at which their audio paths split? Because I don't think we want to send the HD1 audio into a clipper.
You do not want to send that to, you don't want to send preemphasized or clipped audio to a stream or to an HD path. So it does. It shares the path. I was going to show you something different here. It shares, we may as well look here. It shares the path all the way up to the final peak stage. So input AGC, stereo enhancer, auto balance, multiband AGCs, multiband limiters, multiband compressors, all of that stuff shared by the FM and the HD path until we get to the final peak control. That's where we split off. Just like in the Omni 11, the FM path goes to a clipper. The HD path goes to a look ahead peak limiter.
Oh, and that's the HD, the farthest right meter there.
And that's the farthest right. So if I had HD, I don't have the HD core turned on here, but
I saw it running a minute ago.
Let's see if I go over to HD and what do I have going here? And you can use, by the way, you can use different presets in the HD if you want to.
Okay.
Usually we suggest using the same preset because you want the blend to be good. But if you look here, you can see in the middle, see that limiters? We have a final limiter instead of the clipping that we saw in the FM. We're now seeing peak limiters. So we have the multiband limiters, but then we have the final peak limiters, which are a two-stage limiter at the very end. And so we've got meters for those as opposed to clipping meters for. And there we go. Yeah, you can see a little bit of the HD coming in now on that path. So
okay.
You can show the HD meters if you want. That way you don't have to toggle back and forth all the time.
We've got one more topic to talk about, but we got to do it after this last break, and that is the amazing processing that can be done now because we're doing this in the DSP, the digital domain. There's one more place for some pretty amazing processing, and it results, well, I'll just say it results in free loudness. It doesn't result in much more, in any more crunchiness. It can, if you do it wrong, it can, but we give you some pretty cool things there. We're talking to my colleague Jim Kuzman with the Telus Alliance. He wrote the book, literally, on the Omnia 9. And so Jim's a great person to have on here. Our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by my friends at Angry Audio. This is the Angry Audio Bluetooth gadget. I'm seeing this in more and more studios. I was in a studio just last week where they had one of these. If you've got a home studio and you just don't need to get a whole POTS phone line and a POTS phone hybrid in your home studio, you can use the Bluetooth audio gadget in order to bring a phone caller onto your program. It's easy to connect up to. Here, I'll tell you what, I will show you this. There we go. Let's full screen that. This is the website for Angry Audio and the showing you the Bluetooth audio gadget. So you can see here, this is how the front panel controls work. There is a control here for pairing up this Bluetooth audio gadget with anybody's phone that wants to pair up with it. And then on the back of it, we've got audio inputs and outputs here. So you can have you have fully balanced analog stereo outputs to feed your audio console. There is also an AES EBU output if you have that on your console. You can also put this thing, it'll automatically go into mode where if you want to play a song or some music or an interview that's stored on your phone, well, you can easily just play it back through the Bluetooth audio gadget. You don't have to look for patch cords and try to find that dongle for your iPhone to get audio out of it. You just do it with the Bluetooth audio gadget. And it knows if you're having a phone call versus if you're trying to play high quality audio. Either way, it's really, really an amazing, amazing device. So you ought to check that out. The Bluetooth audio gadget from Angry Audio. AngryAudio.com is the website. AngryAudio.com. And you can get them from all your favorite dealers, but do ask for the Bluetooth audio gadget. We'll be right back.
With all of the recent cybersecurity attacks against large corporations, we were looking for a product that would give us the ultimate security at our transmitter sites and as well as with our broadcast equipment. MaxConnect fits the bill very well. Its greatest security feature is the fact that it gives you a single static IP address. Using this single static IP address allows us to close hundreds of open ports on our firewalls across the company and restrict access to only the MaxConnect IPs. This has greatly reduced our exposure to the World Wide Web and made us much more secure moving forward. It has also given us the ability to expand as needed in a secure fashion.
It's John Takak talking about this right here. This is the MaxConnect. These are a couple different models of the 4G LTE modems that they offer. And you know, it doesn't matter which one it is. It's not the 4G LTE modem that does the magic. What does the magic is the SIM card inside, because it is the MaxConnect wireless service. And MaxConnect has made arrangements with the major carriers like Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint, and in a couple other countries as well, to give you prioritized data. You don't have to wait around for the channel to be clear. You get your own path. And you also get a fixed IP address at your transmitter site or at your remote site, whatever it may be. This is a great way to keep tabs on your transmitter site. You can get audio to your transmitter site. You can get alarms. Any IP need you have, you've got a fixed IP address at the transmitter site with MaxConnect. Check them out. MaxConnectWireless.com. MaxConnectWireless.com. All right, we're going to bring Jim Kuzman back in. Jim, I guess we only have a few more minutes, but we ought to take a look here at, let's see, there we go, we'll add it back in. We ought to take a look at the what happens after the limiters and the clippers, because there's some more things we can do in the composite domain that are pretty interesting.
Yeah, so we the Omnia 9 and the Omnia 11. In the 11, we call it one louder. We've heard Frank Foti talk about this. You know, when he talks about the 11, the one louder, and the way that happens is by the use of an embedded pilot. So if we take a second and review what a composite signal is. We were looking at a composite signal earlier. You know, you've got your left plus right. You've got your left minus right. You've got RDS if you have that turned on. You might have some SEAs and some side, you know, other things there. But basically, you've got your, you know, your mono audio and then your left minus right for stereo. And you have a pilot, you know, the thing that turns the stereo light on in the receiver.
Right.
Traditionally, pilot runs maybe 9-10%, mm-hmm. and that takes up 9 or 10% of your overall modulation. So, if I were to in a traditional processor, if we were to turn off the pilot and we were modulating at 100%, we would see the modulation go down to 90% because we've taken off the pilot, and that's 10%.
Exactly.
And then the modulation goes down 10%, and that's 1 dB. In the Omnia 11 and Omnia 9, we embed the pilot. So the pilot is actually an integral part of the composite signal. It's not additive. It's not a thing tacked onto the composite signal. It's done. It's added right in the composite domain. So if I take the pilot level control here and I drop it down to zero, you can see the pilot is down to nothing now. And my modulation, total modulation, is still 100%. So I haven't lost anything at all by taking the pilot away. But what's more important is by adding the pilot back in, I've not created an overmodulation situation. If I look at my demodulated audio, I'm up at 140-150% in my demod, but because the pilot is embedded in the signal, it's all, you know, to the receiver, it's all the same. I'm still getting 100% modulation. So people say, well, 1 dB, what's 1 dB? That's the threshold of what I can hear, that somebody with really good ears can hear in the difference in audio. If we're talking about just regular linear audio, that's true. When you're talking about audio in the composite domain, 1 dB is a huge and very audible, significant difference in a competitive landscape. So by embedding that pilot right in the composite, we've managed to get in. And there really is no downside. I think people say that. Is there a downside? There must be some price to pay. It's literally free. There is no downside. It's a gift.
Wow. Now, I don't know if I'll ever wrap my head around this pilot embedding, this one louder technology, because it's contrary to the way I learned about FM. So there's a neat math trick going on here, that the receivers still get their pilot. You see it on the FFT display. There's the pilot. And the pilot's not jumping up and down in level. You know, we're not composite clipping the pilot.
We're not clipping the pilot. We're not playing any games with the pilot at all. So, no, it's not bouncing. It's not clipping. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, because, like, take a peek at the you know, where if you clip the pilot, you know, remember back in the analog composite clipper days, you know, where you could hear this, you could look at an FFT and you could tell who was using one because the pilot bounced all over the place.
Yeah.
And if you looked at the FFT, it was throwing crud all in and around the pilot. There's nowhere else to hide it. You don't want to mess with the pilot. It's bad for reception. It's bad for the audio. It's just a bad idea all the way around. So by embedding the pilot, we've made that a protected and integral part of the composite signal. And you actually do get an extra dB of loudness.
The other amazing thing here, if you can go back to that display that showed the demodded levels. Mm-hmm. And now I still scratch my head over this. So we have 100% MPX modulation. The mod monitor's reading right up there at 100%.
Yep.
But when we demod the left and the right audio, we get well over 100% on there compared to not using whatever technology that is in this box.
Correct.
Is this a TARDIS box? Is it bigger on the inside than it is on the outside? Is that the deal?
It's sort of an optical illusion, isn't it? I mean, it's because if you look at like a Bellar monitor, an analog mod monitor that's got a composite and a left right demod.
Yeah.
You know, the demod meters are pinned, and the regular composite modulation is sitting right at 100%. It is a little bit of a mind warp. You sort of have to, it goes against everything you and I were taught about this. And you can see in the left, right, and this is a composite only thing, by the way. So depending if you look at the left, right output, you still see the modulation is at 100%, but you'll see the demod follows right along with it. And you'll also see that, you know, the peak control is a little less precise in the left, right. This is why it's, you know, we're back to that. Why do you want to run composite if you can? Because you get absolute brick wall tight no overshoot peak control, and you generate the pilot and you get the extra loudness. So if at all possible, we recommend running the composite output if you can, if you're, you know, if your facilities allow you to do that.
So I think we can't really talk about it because neither one of us understand it completely. But there is in this processor and we now that we have really fast CPUs, mm-hmm. we have time to analyze and play with the composite signal mm-hmm. almost on a sample by sample basis. We can try to make it louder. And I did a paper at NAB a few years ago with Hans von Zutphen, mm-hmm. and he described some of the techniques that he was using to basically stick more audio into little cracks and crevices in the composite signal, thereby giving you free loudness. No more processing, just we're able to, hey, you know what? We can stick a little bit right here and we can flip the phase. And it's just amazing. And I don't know if Leif is doing similar things, but let's just say that our understanding, yours and mine, mm-hmm. we're not the inventors, is that there are incredible techniques to stick more audio in there at no expense to distortion right. or audio processing.
Right, because processing is always a compromise, right? It's a balloon. The envelope's only so big. So,
right.
you know, that's the holy grail of any processor, you know, designer. That's the dream. That's the goal. When you can start minimizing those compromises, when you can get that same level of loudness and not pay a price somewhere in audio quality, you take that all day long.
It's almost like, okay, there's a speed limit, but what if we could straighten the road a little bit?
Right.
Then we could get there a little faster.
Right. If I could make it a straight line, that I can start bending time. I've got my time machine.
Jim, you mentioned.
And if I do it long enough and fast enough, I can actually get there before I leave.
You mentioned that to get every benefit that's built into modern processors, and the Omnia 9 is a fine example. You really want to have, if you possibly can, you want to have the composite output of the processor that contains these benefits mm-hmm. to go into the composite input on the FM transmitter. Right. And it doesn't matter if it's the analog composite, which is typically a BNC cable,
right.
or if it is the AES-192. Mm-hmm. It's also branded as Omnia Direct.
Right.
The AES-192 signal contains all these benefits, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep, By the way, composite over AES, just like micro MPX is a composite over IP.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I'm told, maybe you can confirm or deny, that the benefits of this composite processing, it's not composite clipping, it's right. this composite processing that we've been talking about, those benefits are maintained if you use the micro MPX algorithm yep. to go and feed your transmitter at distance over IP.
Yep, it's the same composite signal. It's okay. You know, we're doing it sort of a compressed format right now with micro MPX to make it more bandwidth efficient mm-hmm. to get the signal out there. But it all starts with the exact same composite signal. So all of your composite stuff is there. All of the goody, if you will, is still there on a micro MPX signal. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's key. And I know people want to feed, you know, a lot of the FM transmitters nowadays have their own built-in processing or their mm-hmm. own built-in stereo generator. Mm-hmm. You feed it AES, you know, left-right AES, and mm-hmm. And they'll either process it or you process it and you still send it
yep.
left-right AES. You're not getting those benefits if you do that. You still may sound very clean and wonderful.
Right.
It's not a problem, but
this isn't a poke at our friends and colleagues in the transmitter manufacturing, but
right.
that's not their area of expertise. We don't make transmitters. They don't make audio processors. They will tell you, and I've had people that you and I know and will publicly say, if it's there, if you need to use it, mm-hmm. but if you've got mm-hmm. something that's made to do it, use that instead. So.
Well, sometimes it is convenient to, you know, have that built into the transmitter, depending on your operational situation. But sure. it probably won't be the optimum. And we're talking about free loudness here. You don't have to process harder to get the benefits of this extra free loudness. And I'm in favor of free loudness. That's fine with me.
You got it.
Science, baby.
That's right.
Jim Kuzman, you have been our guest for the last hour. I thank you so much for that. It's just awesome to catch up with you and to have you share your knowledge with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Kirk. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
I'm Kirk Harnack, and I want to thank our producer, Suncast, for helping us out on this show and every show. Thanks a lot for helping us out. And also Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find other cool podcasts, including What the Tech. That's always a lot of fun on the GFQ Network. All right, we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.